We're afraid to ask. My name is Terrell Chang. I'm an environmental engineer, which means sometimes people pay me to help solve solid waste problems. I'd like to do this pretty informally and have it kind of be a question and answer thing, but just a couple of overall ideas that I can leave you with. One is that a lot of what I tell you may be new information or may be somewhat unsettling or may clash with what you've heard before, and so I don't ask that you believe me, I just ask that you ponder things a little, because what I have is not in mainstream recycling publications or that sort of thing, but I've always felt that Holden is a forum where we can present different ideas or new twists maybe on the sort of information that's being poured on us by media, whether it's TV or radio or magazines or whatever. So let me start with this. Oh, and feel free to jump in with questions. I have one for you. What does that thing mean? Anybody know what that means?
Recycling.
What? Right.
Continuous.
But can anybody tell me what? Okay.
Reuse. No.
Recycle. Yeah.
Is that what it means? I mean, I don't know. I see this, and it's always printed really small, smaller than your little fingernail, and you peer down the corner, and it sort of means this thing is okay. Do we know what the difference is between recycled and recyclable? Is there a difference? Anybody know? Anybody got any answer?
Well, one is a verb, and the other is a noun.
That's good. What does that mean in terms of this thing? If this had this little triangular arrow thing on the bottom, what would that mean to us?
Recyclable.
Okay.
Yeah.
I noticed on some of the Holden literature it says recycled and recyclable.
Right.
And then it says printed with vegetable ink, which is also kind of a nice touch. I bring up this point because it's kind of ambiguous. It's sort of like the new version of the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval, but if it's just only recyclable, we say that about his shoes or, you know, most anything. And is that worthy of any distinction? Is that worthy of our patronage because something is recyclable?
You guys Scandinavians, we all move to the bathroom.
So I guess I toss that out to you to ask yourself next time you see that symbol on something, ask, does that mean I ought to buy this product? Is it really any kind of recommendation at all? Is it something that makes it worthwhile? Let me tell you what I think the triangle means, and I don't know that I've seen it in writing anywhere, but here's my guess. Here's something that's made, and you buy it, and you take it home, and you use it. It's a toy or a book or whatever. And at some point, either you don't need to use it anymore, or it's worn out, or it's broken down to its component parts. So you take what's left, and somebody picks it up, or you haul it somewhere else. And then it's either made into component parts, be they glass or plastic pieces or what pellets or whatever, and then it's made into some other kind of product, and it goes to another store and somebody buys it. I think that's what this means. But in a way, it's a little frightening that here's something that's almost universally recognized, but nobody really understands it.
Yeah.
So, point number one, I think it's always dangerous when we all sort of accept something, but we really don't know what it is that we're accepting. Do people have any questions about how solid waste is handled? Do people have kind of an idea of what happens? Or maybe I should ask, what is your idea? When you put stuff out of the curb, what happens to it? Garbage or trash or recyclables? Does anybody know what happens to that stuff?
They send it to Arlington.
You must be from Oregon. Arlington is an interesting case, just for those who are not from Oregon. Basically, in the desert country in eastern Oregon, there's a very large landfill. It's a 2,000-acre landfill, and they have options on like 14,000 acres more. And they bury garbage out there in a state-of-the-art landfill. Now, that offends some people because garbage is coming in from somewhere else. And yet, if we were to choose a location where we thought it was environmentally sound, i.e. where it didn't have a lot of rain, we might pick a place like that. And we'll touch more on this hauling my garbage to your house kind of thing in a little bit. But okay, so other than it goes to Arlington, what happens when we set stuff out at the curb? What do we think happens to garbage?
Well, you hope that if it's glass, they're melting it down and using it again somewhere. Same with metal, but a lot of times you never really know for sure whether they're just putting it back in with the regular garbage, even though you here you've taken all the time to put a stack of this and a stack of that. I don't know.
Okay. That's a good point. Traditionally, we just had one container or several large cans, and we put it out there, and a man or a woman in a truck came along and threw it at the back of a noisy truck, and it kind of crunched and ground up, and it went away. Now we've really advanced, and now we take out our can, and then we've got bins or bags or something else, and we've spent a lot of time sorting it out. And now two people in trucks come by and pick it up. Have you ever asked yourself, gee, is that a net gain for the environment? Are we using twice as much fuel to drive her out to pick up essentially the same amount of stuff, and now it's in two separate groups, if you will? And the answer is yes, it does. One of the things about recycling is that there's a myth, or at least a half-truth, that recycling can make you money, or even pays for itself. In general, that's not true, and the reason is pretty obvious when we ask ourselves, what is it? Well, there's a lot of wet stuff that packs down, you know, food trimmings and things like that. Pretty dense. But then a lot of the things that recycle are basically containers of one sort, whether they're aluminum cans or glass bottles or plastic bottles or pop bottles, which are another kind of plastic. All these things hold a lot of air inside. And so the truck, unless it squishes all this stuff, is filled up with air for the most part. It's an extremely expensive proposition, plus you have now another laborer, a truck driver, driving around, so you've got twice the salary. And this is one of the things that's often not considered, especially by politicians, when they propose new, higher recycling goals. So to address what you said, for the most part, that garbage goes to a landfill. And as the landfills near cities become full and are closed, the landfill either has to move farther away or we have to do something else with the garbage. The recyclables, as you say, you hope are being melted down and being reprocessed into something else. Let's touch for a moment on glass, and some of you have heard this story before. Most of the green glass in this country is generated in the form of wine bottles and beer bottles, mostly from foreign countries. And not that we're opposed to importing foreign products, but the fact is now, once the wine or beer has been drunk, we've got a lot of green glass left. And I have an article here talking about how they're not going to accept green glass anymore because it's not being reused to the extent that we're generating. Well, why is that? It's almost always impossible to make a new product out of 100% recycled stock. Either the color is not good, or it has imperfections and contaminants in it that make it not structurally sound, things like that. So maybe with glass you can use 20 or 40% of a new bottle might be recycled glass. So now you've got 60% of the old bottle laying around somewhere waiting to be reused. Well, it would be fine if we were bottling a lot of wine and green bottles in this country, but most of it's coming from out of this country. And so we're ending up with green glass piling up all over the place. Now you might ask yourselves, why would we recycle something that's basically made out of sand, which is pretty common in most parts of this country? Well, it's because it's a traditional material, and we've always recycled it, therefore we keep doing it. Secondly, if you have to meet recycling goals in your community because a state or local official says, by God, we're going to recycle 50%, glass is a great thing to recycle because it's heavy, and you can really build up the weight. Don't recycle plastic because it's really light. It's 5% of the waste stream by weight, but glass is pretty heavy stuff. And so now we've kind of got ourselves in a role here. We're caught because we might have some goals. Let me read you a quote from a man named Winston Porter, who used to be, what was his title? He was the assistant administrator for solid waste in EPA. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency from 1985 to 1989. And it says, during his tenure at EPA, Dr. Porter brought attention to the idea of a national goal for recycling, and he was suggesting 25% as a goal, that we might recycle 25% of what we discard. And here's what he's saying now. He said, my 25% was a national target, not a law. Also, it was not meant to apply equally to every state or locality. Congress is considering a national law requiring recycling rates up to 50%, which will probably require suspending the law's supply and demand. But what does that mean? 50% recycling sounds like a great number. But I don't think there are very many people who can say, you know, 50% is a whole lot better than 47, or not as good as 53%. It's a number which doesn't appear to have much basis, in fact, when you look at garbage. And you say, well, is there really 50% of the stuff that we could, in any reasonable fashion, with any reasonable sense of economics, and I don't mean just dollars, but where we would say, you know, that's really a good use of our resources to recycle that. I'm not sure that 50% was... that's how we arrived at 50%. In fact, I have a theory that there was a book published in the mid-80s that talked about recycling rates in Japan and how they were doing 50%. And I would not be surprised if at least some, you know, legislators said, well, the Japanese can do it. Of course we can do it. Well, their whole cultural system is very different from ours. And so what works there may not work over here.
But isn't really the driving force, one of the main driving forces, is this absence of available landfill sites around urban areas now? I mean, that's aside from the economics of everything. You just can't get landfill sites anymore.
The question, and I'm repeating it for the tape, is recycling driven partly by the loss of landfills near urban areas, the lack of land and the difficulty of siting? If there's one thing we have a lot of in this country, it's land. I mean, really, we are blessed with a lot of land. And of the land space that's there, a lot of it is fairly suitable for building landfills. It's not necessarily in close proximity to urban areas. But by the same token, we get food to urban areas that are not necessarily near croplands and that sort of thing. So we know that there's ways to move waste, just like any other commodity, to move it around. One of the biggest myths is that we're running out of landfill space. And here's where I see that happening. You hear the statistic quoted, by 1995 or the year 2000, 70% of our landfills, or some number like that, will be closed. Well, okay, similar story. By the year 2000, 90% of the cars on the road today won't be running. God, we got a shortage of cars, right? Well, the problem is you can always make more landfills. It's not truly a shortage of landfill space per se. They're in close proximity, absolutely correct. It's very difficult. You don't expect to tear down buildings and dig a hole in the ground to put garbage in it. But it's an artificial scarcity because the land is not unavailable. It's politically difficult because for the most part, people don't want to be responsible for other people's waste. Does that sort of address
you? I agree. There's probably land someplace in Nevada or who knows where, Eastern Oregon or what. But you know, I come from the Bay Area, and this is a real problem there. Everybody's yelling and screaming about this. Garbage rates keep going up because landfills are more and more expensive. And every time some county or municipality wants to start a new landfill site, it's like a political civil war. I mean, this is one issue that local people really get hot under the collar. And they'll pass local county ordinances banning these things, even though they meet all of the kind of EPA standards and control the effluent and everything that leaches out of these things and everything. People just don't want them. They're frightened of them. And it's a political problem.
The comment was that people are frightened of landfills and it's really difficult politically. It's political suicide, frankly, to try and site a landfill in your jurisdiction. Now, why do we think that is? Are we really afraid of them? What do we know about landfills, and has anybody ever been to one?
Yeah.
So
there are
maybe
drainage problems around some of them where people living nearby, this is in an area in Pennsylvania where we live, and people who had lived for years near the landfill, their water supply was contaminated, and adults and children were diseased. So
that's a very good point. Historically, we've had pollution problems, and that sort of breeds a mistrust because people thought they were designing landfills before. Well, historically, we know how landfills develop. There's a hole in the ground, people throw stuff in it until it fills up, or somebody mines out the gravel or sand. Now they've got a big hole. They can make money by throwing other people's stuff in it. Well, that's not how we design landfills or build them today. And I think it's extremely difficult to justify or make a decision on the basis of, well, you used to do it like that 50 years ago, and see, it didn't work out, so therefore we should never do it because it can never be saved. Because the garbage will go somewhere. I mean, historically, you're absolutely right, and I know that's the mindset of many people, is they've historically polluted, therefore, you know, how can I trust
them? Well, I think part of it is an issue of trust, too, at a couple of different levels. One is supposedly this landfill was supposed to be lined, and it either wasn't or it wasn't adequately, and the people who were given the responsibility, they purposefully, you know, went around.
Mm-hmm.
But then another issue of trust is, do these linings or do these now present modern day protection devices, do they really work?
Okay, the question is, is today's state of the art really going to be tomorrow's disaster technologically? I would have to, as somebody in that business, I'd have to say, yeah, I have some questions too. But there's no, I guess one of the things is we tend to think we're really pretty smart about things. And we thought recycling, as we're doing it today, was really the cat's meow. It was really going to solve a lot of problems. All we've done is we've shifted the problems. Now we've got a fuel problem, or, you know, we've got too much of one kind of thing that we can't do anything about, which if we'd really been smart, we would have said, wait a minute, we're spending $100 or $200 a ton to collect glass, which we can go out and buy sand for $5 a ton. So why would we do that? So we, in some sense, we trip over our ability to know things. We just aren't getting smart fast enough, and that's part of the human dilemma. When we talk about technology, one of the technologies is extremely unpopular now. And I mean, it's a battle cry. If you say waste of energy or incineration, boy, you're likely to get shot in a lot of places. One of the things that people don't in general realize is that a landfill, the way we're making them now, is you basically have a hole in the ground, you put plastic, several layers of plastic liners, and you put pipes to collect the juices that come out, which are called leachate, in there, and they have to be treated. And we put the garbage in, and then we put a cap over the top that doesn't let in much rain because that would make more leachate. Sounds pretty good? Except that even in old landfills where they didn't do all this stuff, stuff really doesn't decay much. And people have probably seen the National Geographic special by William Rathjay from somewhere in Arizona. He's a professor at some college. Actually, he's an anthropologist, I believe. And he goes and mines landfills. His students go out there and look at what's in there. And, you know, they find pieces, hamburgers or steaks that, you know, really look pretty reasonable. I mean, they're dried, but you know, they haven't really decayed, they haven't disappeared. Readable newspapers. And this is with old-fashioned landfills. So the implication is that with new state-of-the-art landfills, that stuff's going to look like it does today, 50 years from now. Don't pin me down on the number, but it's a long time. It's certainly longer than most people's political careers, which is really the driving force here, right? And so what we're all not thinking too much about, in the same way we haven't all saved up a big pot of money for our kids' college education, is what are we going to do with this stuff 50 or 100 years from now? We're still going to have to be maintaining these things because the tops on the landfills cave in after a while because the garbage does subside. And so then you've got to go out and repair this. And there will be some decay, which means you will generate landfill gas, which is methane and carbon dioxide, and it is explosive. So you're going to have to keep maintaining these things ad infinitum. And that's one of the hidden costs of landfilling. But landfills are nice in one sense because they don't scare people as much as incinerators do. Now we go to the incineration side. What most people have not seen a modern incinerator. And when they do, they don't know that. They always ask whether it's working, it's operating or not. I mean, that's the experience in Oregon when people drive by. Well, I guess it's not operating today because I don't see anything coming out of the stack. That's not the case anymore. Incinerators are much better designed than they used to be. We have a whole lot of air pollution control equipment on them. In fact, we have more air pollution control equipment on waste-to-energy garbage burners, if you will, than we do on most coal-fired plants, which is a staple way of generating electricity in areas where they don't have hydro or nuclear power. But the public is, in general, quite afraid of waste-to-energy. Now, the nice thing about waste-to-energy is once you've taken care of it, you've reduced the volume considerably. So the part that you have left over, the residue that you've got to keep an eye on, a whole lot smaller. It's maybe one-tenth the size. Secondly, it tends to be a lot less active. Well, certainly it's not active at all biologically, but it's a lot less active chemically. And it can be mixed with concrete or cement-type products and reused. In fact, I think it's New York's, one of the universities in New York State actually built concrete blocks of some sort and made artificial reefs out of it to test whether marine life would die off if it got near it. And it's like any other thing you throw in the ocean. Barnacles and reef-type animals all start growing on it pretty quickly. There's really not an appreciable difference. But we have a major hurdle here because the public thinks that babies die when you put it in an incinerator. And so, anyway, that's my spiel on incineration. But you can see there's going to be a long time before people change their minds about that. My prediction is that when in the Northwest we say, well, salmon are more important than turning on lights, so we will cut back on the water flow through power hydropower plants and electricity gets more expensive, then we might start looking at incineration as a way to get rid of a pollution problem, getting rid of some of our garbage, and to make some beneficial, i.e. electricity, out of it. But that's a ways off.
What is the pro or con with incineration with respect to air pollution or contamination?
Okay, the question was, what are the pros and cons with waste energy or incineration with respect to air pollution? One of the blessings and curses, if you will, is that we are now able to measure extremely small things, like parts per billion. I have to admit, I really don't have any physical sense at all what a part per billion is. It's a really small number. And yet we can measure these things. And the more we can measure, the more we get frightened by it, because 3 parts per million is half of 6 parts per million, so if you're putting out 6, you must be twice as bad. Well, yeah, but you have to put it in some sort of context. And one of the ways we put things in context is to look at health risk assessments, which is, in general, a widely misunderstood method of equating some kind of emissions from, say, a waste energy plant with how many additional cancer deaths, for instance. Now, one of the widely misunderstood standards, if you will, and apparently EPA never intended it to be used this way, is 1 additional cancer death per million. And if your project would cause 1 additional cancer death per million of population, then you are probably shouldn't be permitted to be there. Let me explain what that means, the 1 additional death. The way we calculate that is to take somebody who would be at the maximum exposed area and never move from that spot for 70 or 80 years. Pretty unrealistic. And we assume all the worst meteorological conditions. We assume all kinds of things like that. And we all know that those aren't very realistic condition. And that's how we calculate the 1 in a million. Secondly, and 1 in a million is, we all say to ourselves, well, I don't want to be that 1 in a million person that's going to die from cancer because of this plant. What we forget is that somewhere between 250 and 350,000 people in a million are going to die from cancer, from lung cancer. I'm not sure about the lung cancer, but cancer in general. So then the question is, are we really putting things in proper perspective here? I guess without going into a lot of technical details, my own personal feeling is that a modern waste energy plant of the type you would have to build now to get it permitted is so clean compared to most any other kind of burning process, be it automobile exhaust or wood stoves or anything else, that if I had my druthers, I'd be standing next to that plant rather than the tailpipe of your car. I don't know, that's a real rough way of putting it, but I personally believe that we've gotten to the point where we can really minimize that risk and put it in proportion to the other kinds of things that would happen if we were to continue landfilling as we have traditionally. So, yes?
We have a waste incinerator in Duluth, Minnesota. And I think one of the problems is that it also is linked up with wet sewage that comes in.
Sludge.
And smelly. And so people get real angry about, and actually the wastewater treatment has done some wonderful things. It has cleaned up a river in like 3 years that was very polluted because there's paper industry there. But it's so unpopular because of that that smell of the, you know, and it's just on certain days and certain times. But that's the kind of political problems that, you know, when it comes right down to it, whether it's, it muddies the health issue thing, I think, a lot. And it's one of the, I don't know enough about the all the different technologies, but I guess there's so many different technologies as far as incinerators and sludge production and stuff. But this one, I think, combines both maybe some sludge and some garbage burning, too.
Right.
And, but that, the sludge part of it is what has made that plant very popular. Because certain days it smells bad, especially when the paper mill waste comes in.
I guess that's one of the things we have to, in modern life, get used to. As long as we have concentrations of population, we all got to go to the bathroom sometime, and we all create trash or garbage. And those things have to be taken care of in some location, in some fashion. I mean, it's to a large extent population-centered. If there were only one of us per square mile, we could do whatever we want. It wouldn't make much difference. But there are a lot of us out there, and those things have to be taken care of. Let me go to the issue now of where these facilities ought to be, because that's always sure to get everybody upset. Everybody by now has gotten to NIMBY as part of their vocabulary, the not in my backyard syndrome. I ask people to think about this. How would every one of you like a car manufacturing plant in your town and all the related plating and steel mills and all the things that go along with it? How would you like to accept that pollution in your town? See, we don't mind having Detroit and cities in Ohio and, you know, around Michigan taking that burden for us. And we reap the goodies, we drive their cars. But when it comes to taking somebody else's garbage, we're offended by that. We think they ought to take care of that. We don't grow a lot of crops in downtown Seattle. I mean, but that, so maybe we ought to do something to offset that. I guess one of the things I hope that we all start to do is be less parochial. Everybody can take care of their own waste, just like there aren't money center banks. I mean, there are a lot of banks in New York, and they do a lot of the financial stuff, and that's part of the burden, if you will, they carry for the rest of us, to some extent. And certain parts of the country do certain parts of things, be they based on historical factors or climate or whatever. And those commodities flow, and nobody complains because soybeans from Iowa are coming to Oregon or wherever. If we are realistic about solid waste, we would say it should be handled where it can be handled in the most safe fashion and with reasonable economics. I mean, we would think that would be our hierarchy of doing it. And if it happens to all be, let's see, Pennsylvania ships to Indiana, for instance, the Indiana folks don't like that at all. But I guess my point is that we ought to think of waste as just being another commodity. And one way that helps us think about it that way is by hauling stuff by rail. Most people have never seen a garbage or recognized a trash hauling vehicle other than the one that comes down their street and picks it up. I mean, a lot of trash is hauled long distances in what we call intermodal containers or tractor trailer rigs. They look like just any other semi-trailer going down the highway, unless you happen to read the insignia or know, look on the back and can tell something about by the signage. And so it's not necessarily offensive. It's just the idea that somebody would dare dump on me. And I think that's a parochial, outdated mode if we want to start thinking of ourselves as, heaven forbid, one earth, much less one country. So I guess one of the ideas I hope I would leave with you is that we need to consider waste as not being just your. Too bad if you don't have any landfill space. But it's all of our problem, because what affects you negatively and the environment in your state hurts all of us in some way. So. Yes?
I cannot remember the man's name, but it's some fellow who buys up land and then profits by bringing in trash, somebody else's trash. And it's, I don't think that's what bothers me so much as that the lack of regulation, that you are honestly protected, because some states are very lax, and you can set up a garbage dump easier than you can set up some kind of other type of business. And it's done and over with, and the people are left to clean it up because of how it was done. And I think it's more the lack of trust in that it's being done for the people instead of for the profit.
Do you think that's a historical problem? I mean, lack of regulation? Or is that, would you say that's happened in the last 2 years, for instance?
It's been going on for decades. You find out about what they did with the waste in eastern Washington, what they did here and there, and it comes out later, but the EPA or whoever is supposed to be monitoring it wasn't. And there are cities that have leased out land, and it turns out that the company was dumping. You've got an example right here. How a mining company made a lot of money, but guess who's got to clean up the mess?
Okay. Not as an apology for historical practices, but just to maybe try and set things in perspective. Remember when I talked about where our knowledge is? I mean, there are a lot of things that we did even 10 years ago because they were well within the regulations at the time. We don't do now. And what has changed the regulations? Part of it is the advancement of scientific knowledge. The other is being able to measure pollution at a much lower level. And three, and probably most importantly, public pressure. Now, some of that pressure, a lot of it has been just purely emotional. It has nothing to do with what actually are the consequences of anybody doing any particular thing. That's why I guess it's important for us to not throw out the proverbial baby with the bathwater in terms of saying, well, we're not just not going to have any more landfills. Or well, the question is, what are we in fact going to do with it, with what we're generating? And that kind of goes back to this recycling thing, is what are we in fact doing with that, with the 50% of our waste stream that we think we're recycling? I contend that we don't recycle until you go all the way around the horn. And why don't we just ask people, what have you bought recently that's recycled, that you're pretty sure is recycled, not recyclable? Anybody know of anything?
Toilet paper.
Okay. Toilet paper?
Notebook.
Good.
Paper. Notebook
paper, okay.
Newspaper.
Okay. Maybe. Can you tell?
It's a news, well, the newsprint that our newspaper uses is.
Okay.
It's hard for newspapers to find totally recycled, though. Our newspaper prints regularly that they only can get something that's 20-some% recycled. That's the highest they can get so far.
Well, one of the problems, and again, remember when I spoke about how much recycled content you can use, every time you make paper is essentially long strands of cellulose, I guess. Some kind of fiber, and every time you use it or print it or fold it, the fibers start to break, and pretty soon you've got a whole bunch of short fibers. That's why you can never have 100% recycled, because pretty soon your paper, newspaper, falls apart before you open it. What other things? Okay, we've named three paper products.
The plastic bottles, they're making into the pellets, and then they're making, you know, dog houses or some other kinds of little plastic things.
Okay, so some plastic items. If you ever take a scissors and cut open a Procter & Gamble detergent type bottle, you might see, if you've got a magnifying glass, that the inside and the outside are one color, and that's because of the Food and Drug Administration labeling and regulations on what can touch certain commodities. But the middle layer is made up of multicolored pieces of recycled plastic. Now, I know for a fact that the plastic they use would, if it's made from oil, I use virgin plastic, polyethylene might run on the order of 6 to 8 cents a pound. Oh, excuse me, 4 to 6 cents. But to make recycled, it's somewhere on the order of 8 cents a pound. And I know, because I've talked to Procter & Gamble people, that they're doing this because they believe in this, or they say they believe in recycling and being environmentally conscious. But they're also concerned about losing money subsidizing a market. And that's where all of us come in, is how much are we willing to do to subsidize that market? Now, there are several ways that you make a market, one of which is demanding that something appear on your store shelves. And I contend that a very important part that isn't shown there explicitly is demanding certain products. Who in this room has written to a manufacturer and said, well, you know, I'm going to keep buying your product because I notice it's in a recyclable container or it's got a recycled content? Or conversely, I quit buying it, and when I see that it's in a carton that's a lot smaller and you've gotten rid of all the fillers and stuff, I'll start buying it. Who's done that? 29 cents a piece of recycled paper and an envelope will do it. I don't think companies get very much mail like that. But everybody is for recycling. See, we're for the easy part, putting it out on the curb and let somebody take it away. It's very difficult to get us to take the time to go and really demand that somebody do something concrete. And manufacturers are like all of us. We don't go for the high price option unless there's a high price payoff. And manufacturers will not use recycled materials unless they're either way superior to virgin materials, which they generally aren't, or they cost less, or the public demands it and is willing to pay some kind of premium to compensate for. I mean, it's a pretty obvious supply and demand kind of thing, and that's something we can all control. Yes?
Now, the other thing is, I can't remember the exact word, but is it, well, source reduction to get rid of
sure.
packaging and things like that? I know I bought paints, acrylic paints in a tube, and half of them were in an exterior hard plastic box that, you know, was, and I said to the store, I said, boy, I hate to buy these. I mean, certain colors I could only get in this hard plastic box, and the rest were just in the tube, you know, which you probably would have a hard time getting rid of too, but at least it wouldn't. And she said, well, this is the last we're getting because the company has finally gotten the message. People have been complaining and asking them not. So it was nice to hear in that particular area, and maybe it's because artists are sometimes more sensitive to
sure.
things like that. I mean,
sure.
I'm not an artist, so I consider that I'm more a hobbyist. But that was kind of neat to hear, that this one company, that the boxes were the old.
Mm-hmm.
But I think sometimes it's just amazing, the packaging. And I think that's another place that if we can demand simpler packaging and less filling.
And we've been talking about after we make the mess, and I think we need to get involved with before we make them that mess, too.
Yes.
I served on the Humboldt County Grand Jury last year, and we did a study on this. And one of the things that we did this deal about, you know, we needed a new landfill site, and the people that were going to have it in their neighborhood, and we had them come from the east and the west. It was very exciting. But we did get into this packaging thing, and one of the things that this man explained to us was that, for instance, diapers, which, you know, is always a big one, and the little juice containers and that sort of thing, they're trying to put the cost of that back to the manufacturer. You know, there is an awful lot of waste there. I mean, this little juice bottle and in the diapers and stuff, and they're trying to put that cost back so that there would be less of that produced. I don't know how successful it would be, but certainly it's something that has to be done. But I'm with you, it has to go back further than.
I just read a thing that said that if you would talk like to a supermarket manager and leave the excess packaging with them and make them deal with it, then they would be more responsible too. You know, take it out of this package and say, I won't purchase this, I'll purchase this, but I won't purchase this, and then they have to pay for their garbage as well. But that's a roundabout way of getting the manufacturer.
Has it ever been broached to take and reuse containers, having less sizes of containers so that you get shampoo in a certain size that every single manufacturer has its own, but after you're done, it's a perfectly good container, and you go throw it in the trash, and there's a lot of life left. Why couldn't we reuse things?
That's why I'm surprised the store hasn't come up with these big things of Prel and all the stuff when you bring your stuff in and you fill it up and it's the same. I mean, why not?
Why not?
You know, I don't know why.
That's what the Body Shop is made out of, like.
Well, some of your brand name.
Well, let's talk about packaging, or let me throw out some other ideas on packaging, because that's always the first one, and rightly so. That's what consumers see, is what's left after the product's gone. Some of us remember when, I don't know, a dozen years ago or so, a person or several persons tampered with some Tylenol. And in some sense, we're all responsible, not because we asked this person to do it or conspired with them or whatever, but somehow either in how we deal with one another or our training of our children or whatever, we somehow tolerated this kind of action. And maybe that's a loose trail of guilt. But manufacturers don't put packaging on things because they like the looks of it. I mean, they're not putting double wraps. How many seals do you have on any item of food now? That's not because the manufacturer wants to spend a nickel on every package, because that's right out of their profit margin. It's because they have to do that to prevent lawsuits and tampering in the reverse order. And I think we all bear some guilt when it comes to being a litigious society, you know. And it's one of those diffuse sort of things, and yet it's costing all of us a lot of money. Because not only do we have to make the packaging, then we got to get rid of it after we're done with the product, and then we got to haul. We have not only had to haul it one way to the store, now we got to haul it out to a landfill or an incinerator or somebody else. We all pay two or three or four or five times because of all these things. And I don't have any good answers other than the fact that if you do complain or you do write letters, I think you do get some kind of response. And it's at least what we hear from legislators. If they get two letters on an issue, it's, you know, it's a big deal, especially on something like this. And I think manufacturers are the same way. They're out there to survive. Giving the packaging back to the manufacturer or having them pay for it in some sense, you know what that means. We all pay for it some way anyway, because manufacturers pass costs through, just like taxes. They're pass-throughs, and we all end up paying for it. On the issue of payment, let me throw out one other thing, and that's my sense that recycling, by and large, is a suburban, white, middle-class kind of phenomenon. Okay, it's very difficult to recycle in the inner city, not that it's impossible, and there are actually some really good programs in Philadelphia, for instance. But think of it this way. Here we are. One of the ways we encourage recycling is to raise landfill fees. And that is, in fact, what pays for part of the cost of recycling. Well, so now everybody's garbage rate goes up, which means that if you're a poor inner city family, you get to pay an extra $3 a month for the luxury of recycling some materials that may be worth 10 cents. Now, there may be some question of equality and justice here. And I just throw that out. I haven't done any detailed economic studies. But I do think that recycling is, in a large extent, a luxury. In years in the future, we may look back and say, well, we spent a lot of money driving around sand or plastic or paper, whatever, because we thought it was a good thing for the environment. It wasn't so many years ago that here at Holden we said, boy, wood heat, that's environmentally sound. It's a renewable resource. Some of us who have been here in the winter community, when we're choking from the smoke, say, well, maybe it wasn't so environmentally sound after all. And so again, our knowledge base keeps growing, we keep learning things, and you know, what seemed really like a great idea today and really environmentally sound may not be so tomorrow.
Well, that comes up too with the whole issue. To me, it's so frustrating because you want to do your minuscule part of trying to reduce it all. So you're told, don't buy the plastic jugs, buy the cartons. Well, then you find out the cartons have wax on that are just as bad. And so, okay, then go to bottles, and you at least try the bottles that can be. But then you get to the point where you're using, you know, your laundry detergent, and it comes in these little bottles that go. So then you want to go to the big pails, and you end up with the pails. But it's like, what are you doing?
An idea that hasn't been discussed yet that we're trying back in our counties, rural counties in southern Minnesota, is composting.
our landfill was not relicensed by the Environmental Protection Agency, so we had to find some other way to handle it. Minneapolis and their incinerator problems were in the news all the time, and so our county commissioners felt that incineration was not the answer. So we went to composting, and we went to France to get the technology to do that, since they've been doing that for 20, 25 years or so. It's working. One of our problems right now is one of the waste haulers, the largest waste haulers in our two counties went together to create this, is fighting it because of interstate commerce. He has a landfill right across the line in Iowa, which he can haul to a lot cheaper. And because Iowa doesn't, this gets back to the issue, Iowa doesn't have as strict laws as Minnesota, so he can haul to Iowa. If he wins that, we're in trouble because it's almost a $10 million project that we put in. We got a $2.5 million grant from the state of Minnesota. But the compost is available now, and people can put it on their gardens, on their fields. Golf courses are buying it. Right now they're giving it away. I should say that they hope to be able to sell it someday, but they're giving it away.
Now, is this compost made from just yard waste, or is it solid waste?
We have a recycling program, and so all those things are supposed to be taken out, and then what is left goes into there. They have some checkpoints. They have, first of all, styrofoam gets blown off by big blowers, and then anything steel or metal types of things get taken off with big magnets and mm-hmm. that type of thing. I forget. I had a tour of the plant, but there's several checkpoints that gets rid of the things that aren't good, and then the rest goes into a compost process that takes about 6 months before it's ready.
Right. I personally think that a system of this, like the compost one you're talking about, is really worth investigating. Unfortunately, I had a major setback with the plant in Portland, Oregon. Just really set back the whole industry because they had some problems. The way I see it, or one possible solution, and I guess I throw this out not because it's such a great idea, but that all of you might, when solid waste issues are brought up and policies are made in your communities, maybe you would essentially use common sense and say, wait a minute, is that too good to be true? Let me throw out what my dream system is right now, that because people want to participate, that we all continue to sort our waste like we have been. And they've done this, it's called a blue bag program, and basically put all your recyclables in one blue bag that's easy to spot. And you might put newspapers inside another plastic bag or a craft bag inside it to keep it dry. And that rather than a bin, because the bins, one, you have to manufacture them, two, it takes more time at the curb to empty it into the various component bins on the truck. And then you only need one truck, and so all your black or white bags, which are your regular garbage, go in there, and then the blue bags all in the same truck. Now, the guy loading at the curb is pretty smart, so he throws the blue bags on the left side of the truck, say, and the white and black ones on the other side. So when it gets to the plant, it's fairly easy to separate them, and then the bags are ripped open, and those recyclables are then sorted in the way that you've described for that existing plant. The other stuff, for the most part, could be wet garbage, wet garbage, paper, soil paper products, and that is what becomes a feedstock for compost. Now, one of the major hurdles to doing all this is, one, the fact that solid waste hauling companies make a whole lot more money driving two trucks than they do one truck, although if you make it worthwhile, they'll do this other system for you. The other one, frankly, is acceptance of this compost. A lot of people are still afraid of it, and frankly, we need to do a lot more testing. We need to refine these methods a lot more. And then third, agricultural acceptance, because there's only so much compost you as an individual can put in your yard. But I see technology not being the sole solution, but technology can help us reach the social ends that we desire. Let me throw out a couple other things that have been in the making for years, and we still don't seem to be able to get them done. One of which is, we all know that tires wear out quickly when they're on your car, but they never wear out when they're in a pile, kind of thing like that. And they're very dangerous once they get in their pile and a fire starts. It's extremely difficult to put out the fire, and they create a tremendous amount of air pollution when they burn, uncontrolled. Now, they can be burned in cement kilns, quite clean, and or in special incinerators. The other thing is that they can be ground up, and you can use a certain amount to do running tracks and kids' playgrounds and stuff like that. But there's one need, and a lot of states have tested it out, but they don't seem to all be able to get together and say this is really worthwhile doing, and that is adding what we call crumb rubber, it's very finely ground rubber, to asphalt mixtures. And some of the data that I've seen says that it wears better, it's less likely to freeze, and especially in places like Minnesota or Michigan where you've got all this cracking and frost heat and stuff, that it holds up better. I just read a thing recently that said, well, unfortunately, nobody's put all the states' reports together and analyzed the data as a whole body. It's this state has done this, and this, because we can't get the Federal Department of Transportation to make this a high priority. Now, I leave it to you as to whether that's a letter-writing campaign or not, but there are things like that, and the same thing for glass, frankly. We don't care what color glass goes into asphalt, but ground or broken small pieces of glass work relatively well in place of gravel or sand, because sand, of course, is what. And so, you know, it seems like maybe it's too good to be true. I don't know enough about the technologies in there or paving, but possibly glass, rubber, and traditional asphalt mixture might help us solve two waste problems, if you will. And I guess, let me leave you with the idea that I think technology holds a lot of promise, but there has to be an economic reason for people to go and invest the time and do the research and then make a product, and you know what the long time lag is between a brilliant idea and making any money off of it. But I think we as citizens need to, one, question what's happening with solid waste in our communities and regulations that are being foisted on us, if you will, to either protect us or because politicians think that that's what we want. I think we need to examine those closely and really be informed and ask questions. A lot of this stuff is not above everybody's heads. It just takes time to sit and think about it. And then third, I guess, the idea of putting pressure on manufacturers, you know, write to the people whose products you like and say, hey, I like it, and I'm going to keep buying it because. Those kinds of things. And you know, as a matter of cost, each of us, 29 cents a letter, a piece of paper and an envelope and an hour of your time. My sense is that that's how things can get done, because otherwise, those of us in solid waste management business will still do what we perceive the public wants, which is what their elected officials tell us they want. And I don't know that your elected official really is representing your clearest desires in the field of solid waste management. So, other questions?
I'm just curious, because you probably know, when I had lost the rest of the story, those plastic bags that there was the in the Seattle area that they stockpiled and they went somewhere, whatever happened to those? Like Pansay was doing the same thing about saving your bags.
I don't know about that in particular. Plastic bags are what we call film plastic, and heretofore have not been a very good market. Partly because there's always potential contamination, and as in a lot of things, these commodities go offshore and get sorted in places where they're short on raw material but long on labor, inexpensive labor. And that's one way of reclaiming things. But I don't know that issue in particular. One other thing, and I'd ask you, in terms of recycling, when we say recycling, we usually think of reusing the material in the sense of its structural or chemical components, i.e. broken glass or used glass becomes another glass bottle, old pop bottle, plastic, PET pop bottles become more pop bottles or else they're ground up and they become the fuzz on tennis balls or the stuffing in your jacket or down, your pseudo-down jackets. But we're using the physical and chemical properties of it. What we're generally not recovering is energy, and that's what's often missing when people say incineration. It's as if you wasted the thing. That's not true. Most things other than metals and glass have an energy value to them, and while the energy can be recovered by waiting for the item to decompose in a landfill and generating methane gas, it's a lot quicker to burn it. And so I would just ask, when that issue comes up in your town, and it will come up within the next 5 years, think about recovering the energy value of an item, not just the the physical properties or the chemical properties of that material. And think of that as another form of recycling. Other questions?
Go ahead. Which is really better, to buy your vegetables in little paper bags or that filled plastic? I mean, one store has a choice of both, and then the other one just has those kill me things. And sometimes I come home with six of those, how many vegetables I bought. And then if I choose to do the paper bags, then I've got paper bags. You can't very well take them back to the store because I never remember, no matter where I put it.
Okay, this is Stump Dr. Science. Which is better, plastic bags for vegetables or paper bags? To tell you the truth, I don't know. Let me tell you what I perceive the pros and cons are. Plastic is lighter, so it takes less energy to drive the bag to your house with the vegetables in it. Plastic retains the moisture, so if you've got something that's fairly wet, it's better to have it in a plastic bag than a paper bag that rips out, so then you use two paper bags. They're both recyclable in some sense. People on one hand say, oh, gee, use paper because it's a renewable resource. And then you get other people saying, oh, my God, they're cutting down trees, and that means then we have erosion problems, and then fish die in the streams because of the erosion. And these are very complex choices. And one of the things that I'm always faced with when I give talks like this at Holden is somebody actually expects me to have an answer. And they're all kind of value judgments, and they're small, and I guess we don't really know. And you kind of have to look at the bigger picture. A lot of people are going to these cloth bags, and pretty soon we'll find out that cloth is really a bad thing because of the dyes. I don't know.
Good for groceries, but not good for
vegetables. Right. I guess maybe one other thing that I forgot to make is that, bring ourselves back to Holden now in the community in Christ that we are here. And that is, I don't think we're asked to be perfect. I don't think we're asked to know those kinds of answers, not because they're unknowable, but just because there's so many things to weigh. And I think your intention and the good-heartedness that with which you do things really counts for a lot. Shows what a lousy theologian should stick with solid waste, right? I guess you kind of have to, in some sense, you can get really confused by all the issues. And at some point, maybe you have to give up with your head and go with your heart. When we did this session last year, one of the women said, I'd like to have a party and I'd like to serve wine, but now I'm concerned about whether it ought to be white wine or red wine because of the green bottles and all that. And then secondly, should I serve it in glasses? Or should I serve it in plastic cups? And because then I have to wash the glasses and plastic cups. But no, Deanne, serve it in glasses and then throw them in the fireplace when you're done. You had a question?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could be a little bit more specific about the safer and more economically feasible sites for some of these incinerators that we might be needing. I mean, is it basically just your isolated desert-type areas, or can you be more specific about communities that are maybe pinpointed across the country?
Okay, the question has to do with where might you site an incinerator? What would be a favorable as opposed to a landfill?
Yeah, and in part I'm wondering because we're situated here in the West, which has more land as opposed to the East. So are we looking at sites in the western third of the country, which will be getting the eastern waste because in terms of transportation and that kind of thing?
Incinerators, more so than... Landfills are affected by the topography and the geology of where you're locating. You don't want to put it on a fault line, that sort of thing. Incinerators, to some extent, are less sensitive to the ground on which they sit, but more sensitive to the climatic and weather conditions, prevailing winds, that sort of thing. The base of a mountain would be a poor choice for an incinerator because air would cool as it came over the mountain and tend to push pollutants down. While people are generally bothered by this, to some extent, dilution is the solution to pollution in that you wouldn't want to put your mouth over or your nose over the top of a smokestack or a chimney, an incinerator. But once that air, the concentrations of pollutants in it are dispersed, it's really not a problem any more than you wouldn't want to put your mouth next to the tailpipe of your car, but or run your car in a closed garage. So it has to really do with dilution, and that has to do with prevailing winds and that sort of thing. Incinerator sites are, as I say, less sensitive to the ground.